This is Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com.
Greetings, super friends. My name is Sonia Simone, and these are the Confessions of a Pink-Haired Marketer. For those who don't know me yet, I am a co-founder and the chief content officer for Copyblogger Media. I'm also a champion of running your business and your life according to your own rules. As long as you don't lie and you don't hurt people, this podcast is your official pink permission slip to run your business or your career exactly the way you think you should. And today I am awfully pleased to be talking with John T. Unger about marketing for more creative outputs, because I get a lot of questions from musicians, novelists, painters, cartoonists about, you know, well, this is all fine for dentists and graphic designers, but I don't see how it applies to me. So I'm chuffed to have you. John, welcome.
Thank you, Sonia. I'm glad to be here.
Len, I want to kick off for people who don't know you yet. If you could just tell people what you do, because you're not only an artist, but you're working in a medium that's, you know, not watercolors, or it's not something that people are maybe so familiar with.
Right. I'm a sculptor primarily, but 10 years ago on the 30th of May, I came up with the Great Bowl of Fire, which is a flame-designed fireball or fire pit. And the stock language here would be sculptural fireballs handmade by artist John T. Unger are luxury fire features valued for exceptional beauty, craftsmanship, and design. And they're made from recycled steel, you know, and that really changed my art career trajectory quite a bit, because yeah. I made the first one. I thought it was a one-off. I thought it was a cool idea. I put it on the internet. It got picked up on Boing Boing and a bunch of other sites. And, you know, now 10 years later, I've shipped almost 1,700 of them to all 50 states and, I don't know, 16 or 17 other countries. I've lost track. Someday I have to go back and get a proper number on that. But, you know, they really took off. And, you know, part of the reason is because they're really well made and they're really beautiful. Part of the reason is because they're not just sculpture, but they're also functional. They serve a purpose. And so, you know, the way that I've marketed them is a little different than you would fine art.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I think they're, to use Godin's much overused adjective, they are remarkable. I mean, people say, mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. You know, it's kind of art and it's kind of function and it's all of them together.
Yeah. You know, I, one of our biggest challenges is, of course, we immediately had a bunch of knockoffs and, you know, we've spent incredible time and energy and money stopping that, not because we're worried about losing sales per se, as much as because customer service is a huge part of what we do.
Right.
And people who do knockoffs are less concerned with that. They're often a little more fly by night,
yep,
looking to
right.
make a quick buck, not looking to make a global reputation that's going to stand the test of time. You know, and we're at a credible copy. It could be mistaken for my work, and if somebody had a bad experience, they would think they had it with me.
Right.
And so that's why we're in, you know, that's why we have a really good copyright lawyer on speed dial.
not really nice, but, you know, useful.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we quite like him as well. So,
yeah.
You know, he's a you know, fun to hang out with and a pleasure to do business with and very effective.
Nice.
But, you know, that's one of those things, though, is part of what's enabled me to make a living in the arts is that I have something that's very unique and that we keep it that way. And, you know, using the internet and all of that gives us a global platform. But I can talk about different segments back because there's some interesting stuff. What can I say? It's like we have a great product and we really have taken just so much time to write clear content for the site, get a good design for the site, you know, work with other people to improve that, you know, and that makes a big difference.
Yeah, I agree. Let's dive into a little nitty gritty, and I'll kick off with a point I kind of touched on earlier, which is, you know, when you're in a creative space, people don't, quote unquote, need what you have. They don't need a painting. They don't need a piece of music. They don't, you know, actually need a pair of $1,200 shoes either. This is what I think of as the desire sliver, you know, of the marketing mm-hmm. world. Some people sell orthodontia or, personal training. And then some people sell just things that create desire because they exist. I didn't know I wanted, nobody knew they wanted an iPhone until they saw an iPhone.
Right.
And it wasn't about what it did.
Although sort of everybody always wanted a tricorder and was just waiting for the iPhone.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, close, you know. they wanted it. It just wasn't there.
Yeah, and I think that's what the artist, in a way, I mean, an artist with an eye to the audience, because some people are really creating for expression and, you know, to find their own search for meaning, and that's awesome. But we're talking about people who are looking for an audience who would like to own your art and pay you money for it. So, mm-hmm. you know, creating that desire is a big part of it, I think.
Part of why I got into making art was, you know, when I was less successful financially, I just loved art. I wanted to own art. I couldn't afford the kind of stuff I wanted. So I made my own versions of that, mm-hmm. you know. And the more of it I made, the more it piled up and the more I got good at it. And I thought, you know, I was working in design until the big .com crash.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was like, you know, instead of learning to do something else sensible, I'm just going to do the art thing.
Yeah.
Because that's what I want to do. And I'll figure out a way to make it work. And, you know, the basic rule of thumb was, like, I know people who went to art school and they miss it because they don't have deadlines.
Right.
And what I did was I made my deadline, the bills are paid by the end of the month, and I'm doing it with art.
Right.
You know, that was my deadline. And the other thing I figured out was that, you know, prior to that, I was working, you know, 30 or 40 hours a week in an office, and then, you know, another, you know, 40 hours a week making art. I was like sleeping 4 hours a night. I was like, if I took those 8 hours where I would have had a job and spent all of that time learning and implementing the business and marketing needed to sell the art,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was better off. Because, you know, really, who wants a day job? And in a way, or at least in your audience, I suspect there are not a lot of people who want a day job. anyway.
They ran away a long time ago.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that, the, you know, the Fireballs effectively became my day job. And then, you know, I make other art that I care about or do other projects that I care about, you know, in the off hours.
Yeah.
I just did this commission that was, you know, a 10-foot tall by 16-foot flag made out of, American flag made out of Budweiser caps. It was a beautiful object.
It was a really cool object, yeah.
You know, it was very cool. And that took, you know, about 4 months of my time.
Yeah.
You know, and the next project I want to do is a bunch of mosaics of 16th century anatomy drawings in marble, because marble just happens to come in the same colors as the inside of people. You know, exact same color palette, which is what makes it work. It's interesting to me. But, you know, probably not highly marketable.
Maybe,
you know?
Right, yeah.
But
yeah.
Then again, that show with the plastinated people does really well in museums. So maybe,
right.
maybe it can be a touring exhibit.
Yeah.
I don't know yet. It's just something I want to do for me. And the Fireballs, and I guess, you know, that's one of the things I would say to artists if they want to make a living in art, is it helps if you have something that you can make somewhat useful, or that you find a niche that you know you can either reproduce or, you know, produce on a schedule to pay the bills, and then do the stuff that might be more experimental in your off hours, you know, and
right.
some people would call that selling out. But then again, you know, when I started, everybody's like, oh, you'll never make a living as an artist. And then when I did, they were like, oh, you've sold out. And what it really boils down to is I don't need to make either of those groups of people happy. You know, if they're not
yeah.
my customers, and you know, and even if they might be friends, you know, it's like, hey, that's your take. In the meantime, you know, here I am making art for a living,
right?
which is what I wanted to do. So, you know, I think one of the best pieces of advice I can give to artists, and they're not necessarily gonna like it, is there's this great Flaubert quote. I can't remember. something to the effect of, you know, be boring in your life so you can be violent and original in your work. I should have pulled it up beforehand to quote it properly. But the thing is, you know, I'm not just making art, I'm running a global business. And that can take up a lot of your time and get really overwhelming unless you come up with systems for it and get really organized. And the best way to explain it is like shipping these things is, you know, was very expensive and very difficult in the beginning. They're like 200 pounds. Yeah. You can't use FedEx or UPS. You've got to use freight. And so solving that problem, finding a good partner that can get your stuff where it needs to go reliably and on time and affordably, solved a huge problem. You know, and we've changed companies a few times over the years for different reasons. Once I've got that problem solved, I don't have to think about it until there's a problem, you know, and I can just keep doing that way. Or, you know, building a website. One of the most important things I want to say to artists about a website is that, you know, a lot of the time I see artists' websites where the navigation is really funky or unclear. Right. And it's very cute or it's very you, but it's not very easy to navigate. And I used to do my own design on all my websites. I did all my own code. I don't anymore. I hire designers and I hire people who write better code than I do because, you know, they can get it done faster. They can get it done better. They can make it easier for people to use. You know, their job is staying up on, you know, new trends on the web. I used to do that, but I don't have to do that if I pay somebody. And it's expensive, but you don't have to do it every year.
Yeah.
You know, get it done, get it really good. And, you know, like I said to you earlier, I'm thinking about redoing mine. But, you know, the last time I did was, I don't know, 2010 or something. You know, it's time to make it mobile responsive.
Yes, John.
Because stuff changes.
Well, and the thing is, you know, getting a designer in, it's a cost for sure, you know. But it's, you know, there's a cost associated to somebody leaving your website because they have no idea what, like how to navigate the interpretive dance of your navigation. That's not the place for your originality, actually. Web navigation is a place to be really boring and predictable.
It just really is. And it goes back to that quote. It's like some stuff, get it really basic, get it really clean. You know, and then show your creativity in the places where people want it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a couple things that are interesting that I'm going to tell you that are counterintuitive. You know, early on, back when I started this, back when there were like 500 blogs in the world or something, you know, I got a huge surge of traffic for something that I had done, you know, like your basic viral thing, right? It wasn't the thing I made a living on, and the people who came in to see it weren't the sort of customers for the stuff that I do for a living. They were just curious, you know what I mean? And they came and they looked and they left. And, you know, out of like 100,000 visitors, which was huge back then. Nobody left a comment. Nobody bought anything. You know, they all came and looked and left.
Yeah.
And that's gratifying, but it doesn't do anything for my business, right?
Right.
And, you know, when we promote this flag, I mean, I think we're going to get kind of the same thing. We're going to get a huge amount of traffic from people who are curious, but who are probably not necessarily our customer base.
Right.
You know, and even still, that's worth something, but it doesn't help your bottom line. You know, here's the funny thing is, you know, we're running a six-figure business, and on an average day, I get like 100 unique visitors to my website. Which is not very many.
No, it's tiny.
You know,
I use you all the time as an example of somebody. You don't need a massive email list if you have the right people on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what's interesting is a few years back we had a sales rep, and we had somewhere over 100 different online stores reselling our work, right? And it became like a full-time job for her to make sure that, you know, the sales copy was accurate, the things had the right name on them, the price was correct, et cetera. And after a few years, I looked and I was like, wow, you know, out of those 100 stores, there are only about six that sell more than one a year, and most of them don't sell any.
Right.
Whereas I was selling like 250 off of my little site that had no traffic.
Right.
And so we cut it down to the top six. And then a year ago, we cut it down to two. The only other places I sell my work now are Front Gate and One Kings Lane.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And both of those are great places. I mean, they have a great reputation. They have a huge list of customers who repeat, you know, who go back to them that are not customers I have.
Right, right.
You know, and so they did a really nice volume for us last year. But, you know, in order to sell through those places, I've got to give them 50% of the retail.
Sure.
And then take my expenses out of it, out of my half. And we're considering whether or not that's still a good idea for us.
Right.
We could be exclusive to just us, and we would lose some sales, but we'd be getting the full retail price on all of them.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be losing customers to their sale days. So I don't know. That's something I've got to give some thought to. But, you know, it goes hand in hand with, like, selling on Etsy, for example, which a lot of artists do.
Sure.
And with Etsy, you've got just massive people going to Etsy every day to shop, right? Just millions of people. So you're being exposed to a huge group of people, but you're also in competition with every other artist on the site.
Yeah.
Right? And I've been selling on Etsy since, I think, the year they launched. But, you know, I typically get 3 to 6 sales there, again, compared to, like, you know, a couple hundred on my site. Would I stop selling on Etsy? No, because there's no reason to stop. I might as well get those 6 sales.
Right.
But it hammers home the point I want to make to artists that, you know, just selling in a crowded marketplace is not necessarily your best. It's easier than having your own site.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd never be able to actually make a living doing just that.
Yeah. So I think I know the answer to this, but do you consider yourself a marketer? Is that part of your self-definition?
Yeah. I mean, you know, because it's so much of what we do. And I mean, you know, right down to the point where it's like, it's one of these days we're going to write a house style guide just so that when we hire other writers or something, yeah, it's like we don't have to keep correcting them. Because there is a very specific way I communicate to the world, you know.
Right. Yes, there is, John. Yes, there is.
Casual yet articulate yet, you know. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I learned lots from Seth and from Brian Clark, especially about writing, back when Copyblogger was a new site. I mean, God, the best writing advice I ever got in a lot of ways came from Brian, year one. But yeah, I mean, I you know, yes, we are marketers, but am I at a point now where I consider farming that out in different ways? Yes. You know, if I want to put a press release out, I'll get somebody who does that and has the lists and has the PR accounts. I want to rebrand the studio as being part of the Hudson Valley art scene because we moved here about a year and a half ago. And it's like, yeah, somebody with a lot of local media contacts would be a good person to go to for that.
Right.
You know, and I'll write the stuff or else I'll hire somebody to write it and then I'll rewrite it 10 times.
Right. Yep.
You know,
it takes more time to have somebody else do the draft, but
I like having somebody do the draft for the structure and then I'll go in and put it in my language.
Yeah.
That's what works for me because I'm a better editor in some ways than writer. But anyway, you know, yeah, I mean, definitely marketing is a huge part of what we do and, you know, and the business end of it too. It's like, I was one of the first artists who was really selling on the web before Etsy came along. And, you know, back when it was considered really crass to have any commercial aspect to a blog or a website.
Heresy, right? Blogs were supposed to be pure about what you had for breakfast.
You know,
they weren't supposed to be.
You know, and so, you know, I feel like I pioneered a lot of this stuff. And, you know, definitely there are people making way more money doing it than me. But that's okay, because, you know, we're doing fine.
Yeah. I'd love if you want to talk a little bit about some of the specific things that work well for you in finding buyers for your work. And, you know, you've already kind of let us know, it's not a big, for you, it's not a big traffic, it's not a big numbers game, it's not, you know, lots of website hits, it's not a big email list. It's a very focused email list. But do you want to talk about some of the tactics, if you will, that that you have found effective and maybe other people might be able to try out?
Okay, one of the most important things is good photography. Mm-hmm. You know, really good photos of your work. And that can either be, you know, professional photos shot on a white background, or it can be your work in a setting, you know, I mean, like the fireballs make more sense to see in a garden setting.
Right, right.
But really good photography, really good sales copy. And, you know, when I say that, I'm talking about something a little different, because I trained as a poet. I was a poet for 15 years before I did anything else, mm-hmm. and even performed on stage at Lollapalooza. So I was great at being a poet. You couldn't get paid at all. You know, fortunately, a poet can live out of a backpack, but, you know, you only want to do that in your 20s. Anyway,
right.
You know, and it was fun in my 20s. It was great. You know, but anyway, you know, for me, the sales copy needs to be somewhat poetic, and it needs to tell a story, and it needs to do more than just say, oh, this is a thing you can use. It needs to give people a reason to care about it and mm-hmm. think about it as an object that's going to last hundreds of years and be part of their family and probably become part of their family traditions, you know. So great photography, great writing, obviously great, you know, design for your website and your newsletter. And again, you know, typically you probably want to work with a professional to tell them what you want, but take their advice, mm-hmm. you know, and utilize their skills. Using different markets. I mean, you know, so we do have One Kings Lane, and we do have Front Gate, and we do have Etsy. And a big one for us this year has been Houzz, which is a, you know, site all about home renovations and has a huge base of people who are specifically thinking about nothing but working on their house. So it's
right.
a great market for the Fireballs. And it's the first time we've ever actually spent money on advertising. Because
mm-hmm.
I was always... Yeah, I didn't feel like I could compete with Home Depot for the keywords I need on Google AdWords.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
There's no way. It's just ridiculous. But on Houzz, I can take out, you know, it's weird because their ads are all regional. They don't do a national advertising plan. So you pick a couple areas where you think you're going to do well. And, you know, a week after we put up advertising on the site, we had sold enough to cover a year's worth of advertising. So.
Nice.
You know, we feel like that's working out for us.
Yeah.
Video is a really great way to promote a lot of different kinds of art. You know, taking a page from Austin Kleon, talking about your process and how you do things and what
mm-hmm.
you do and why. That whole show your work thing is, you know, basically brilliant. And it's a cheap book. If you haven't read it, go buy it. It's good. It's great.
<Right. laughs>
You know, for us, instead of advertising, we focused on press, too.
Yeah.
I felt like if you're in the New York Times, if the New York Times writes about you, which it's done twice for me, you know, that says so much more than a paid ad.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that's somebody saying, oh, this person is noteworthy.
Yeah. Yeah, going back to the Austin Kleon point, because I have seen this, I've done a little bit of work helping art galleries with marketing their, the work that's shown there. And one of the things that I notice great art salespeople do is they tell the story of the piece. So it's like, mm-hmm. because you give somebody that dinner table bragging rights, right? Like, so there's a piece of
mm-hmm.
glass or a painting or whatever it is, or even an MP3 that's playing on the stereo, and they can say, oh, this is this, you know, guy I discovered, and he does this amazing process, and he uses 28 different colors of glass that he gets from Venice, or, you know, or this guy, you know, was Leonard Cohen's valet, or, I mean, you know, whatever it is that's in the story,
mm-hmm.
the buyer has a bragging story to tell about how cool he is for buying this thing.
Well, like, you know? One of my favorite pieces of art was done by an artist local to the area we grew up in. He was a family friend. I never knew him because he died the year I was born. Mm-hmm. But Charles Culverin, I had this portrait of a crow. There was a portrait of my dad's pet crow, Peter, who my bedtime story was about how when Bakelite was new, Peter would fly across the street, grab the neighbor's clothespins, take him on the roof. Neighbor would come out and shake his fist, and Peter would stand on the roof and say, go to hell, go to hell. Which, you know, I mean, that story explains so much of how I became who I am.
Yeah. I think that this crow is your spirit animal. I think it's very
positive. You know, but, you know, it was one of the few things that I really wanted when my grandmother passed, because she had it and I got it. And then, you know, before we left Michigan, I went to Charles Culver's son and bought like a bunch more of his work. But, you know, when people come into the house, you know, that picture's in the dining room and the whole room is Charles Culver with a couple other people, you know, and I tell that story, you know, in a little more depth than we have time for here, you know, and that makes the piece so much more meaningful.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, you know, there's different levels you appreciate art on. Some of it's just visual. Like a lot of my collection is African and Haitian work, and I love the religious symbolism of all the things that are incorporated into the work, but I love the way it looks. I love the story of where it came from, what purpose it may have served, because most of them had sort of some religious purpose, you know. So on all those levels, art affects people. And, you know, when you want to sell art to people, giving them that story,
yeah,
about the piece or the artist or the materials, or, you know, a good example, the Great Ball of Fire, the fireball I make with the flame design, that was the first design. It's a fire pit with flame designs cut with a torch that burns at the heat of the surface of the sun. You know, so you take, and it's made from a recycled propane tank. So you take a container for flammable gas, you cut flame designs into it with a torch so that you can have a fire in it. It's like fire all the way down, you know,
yeah.
It's like all these different levels of, you know, and one of the things I like to say about my work is that the meaning is encoded in the materials, which is something I learned from African art, where something becomes part of a piece because of what it symbolizes or, you know, and I think, you know, yeah. So on some levels, what I do as a visual artist just draws so much from being a poet. It's really when I stopped telling about the world through words, I wanted to talk about different stuff, and it was better suited to visual art.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting and valuable. I mean, I think most successful creative people are storytellers. And so, you know, some people tell stories, we tell stories in different ways. And we tell different kinds of stories, but there is that big story piece of the brain that is always hungry. And maybe more so now, you know, that we are in a Home Depot world, that we are in a world of mass story, mass production, you know, that there is a longing. And I think that is a big part of what artists do sell, is a longing for a recording artist that's not auto-tuned and, you know, a sculpture that's made by somebody's hands and...
I get people who are like, well, but I could go buy a fire pit at Home Depot for $100. I'm like, you absolutely can.
So any one of you who might have had the chance to have a drink with John at some point in your life or sit down next to him for a meal will know that he is not into the whole brevity thing. So we went rather long on this interview and I didn't want to cut chunks of it out. I really thought all of it was valuable. So we're going to continue this interview in next week's podcast, and we'll just break it up into parts for you to keep them to a manageable size. These have been the Confessions of a Pink-Haired Marketer, and they're brought to you by the Rainmaker Platform, the complete website solution for content marketers and online entrepreneurs. Find out more and take a free 14-day test drive at rainmaker.fm/platform. Thanks so much. Take care.